when cloud technologies came out, the number of institutions that said, oh, we could never put any of our data into the cloud. We could never use service-based models. Today, they're all putting their data in the cloud. They're all using service-based models. So I think there's also just a recurring resistance to adapting to new technologies, which in this case is being exacerbated because the technologies themselves really are very disruptive to the underlying business models of many of the participants in the space.
You're listening to CoinDesk's Money Reimagined with Michael Casey and Sheila Warren.
Hello and welcome to Money Reimagined. I'm Michael Casey and I'm here, as I usually am, with my co-host Sheila Warren. Very glad to be here. I've been on a book tour with Frank McCourt. Some of you would know about that. My new book with Frank is called Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, and sort of a topic that about the future of the internet that weaves its way into many of our discussions. But today we're here to talk to Sandy Cowell, who is the Senior Vice President, Head of Digital Asset and Industry Advisory Services at Franklin Templeton. I'll also note that Sandy was recently named by Forbes as one of the crypto gals in a 2023 Forbes 50 over 50 list. She truly is a thought leader in this. But before we get to Sandy, Sheila, how are things with you?
Well, I survived the great quake in New York, as did you.
By not being here, you were here, right?
I was there. I derived tremendous entertainment.
I escaped. I was in Ann Arbor.
As a Californian, I derived tremendous entertainment. The number of alarms and emergency alerts that went off for what in California would have been a total non-event, just a reminder that we all have very different experiences and should be open to recognizing that not everyone has the same experience in life. But made it. And we are recording on the day of the eclipse. So
end of days. New York has a quake and then there's an eclipse and then Bitcoin crashes or something. You know, it's all...
Between weather events and unlikely seismic events, it's just kind of, we are in times where you just never know what's going to happen, Michael. You just never know what's going to happen. So
which makes it
fun. Got to be along for the ride.
Indeed. Anyway, why don't we get Sandy in?
Good.
Here she is. Good to see you, Sandy.
Good to see you guys. Thank you so much for having me today.
You're most welcome. We're really sort of keen to hear. I think have interviewed a couple of times on stage the CEO of Franklin Templeton, Jenny Johnson, and have always been impressed by how, you know, this relatively old institution, I think, you know, fairly comfortably in most people's eyes would be labeled as TradFi, has been really pretty innovative at the cutting edge of a lot of new ideas for digital assets. And I think, you know, you've won the hearts of the crypto community for that. But Sandy, you've been a key player in all of that. So why don't we just like talk a little bit about your background and then how you came to sort of spearhead this rather unorthodox strategy for, you know, a big mutual fund manager like Franklin Templeton.
Yeah, well, thank you. I've got one of those crazy backgrounds where I did a little bit of everything for many years. I was a research analyst. I was a wire service reporter. I was a portfolio manager. I was a technology consultant. I was a management consultant. And then I finally ended up about 2010 or so, starting a thought leadership practice at Citi, where we really looked forward and tried to really forecast what was going on in the industry, the investment management and wealth management industries, looking at two timeframes, looking at the 1 to 3 year timeframe, which we considered to be industry evolution, because those were things that people had clearly on their radar, were either already working on or already planning. And then we really started thinking, longer term, what was going to be disruptive to the industry and where might we see more revolutionary trends come into play? And that was when I really started focusing on blockchain and Bitcoin back in 2013 and honestly didn't know what to think the first couple of years. Just kind of had it on my radar and was watching. Wished I had invested back then, but did not. But then in 2015, when we started hearing about Ethereum and smart contracts and the virtual computer and, you know, this whole idea of self-executing terms and this idea that a contract could be embedded in an asset, that was just such an aha light bulb moment for me personally. And that was when we really started pushing the industry on what they thought. And we came out with our first paper on tokenization in 2017. And Jenny Johnson at Franklin Templeton was one of the CEOs that had engaged quite extensively around that paper. She really wanted to understand that thinking. She really wanted to understand the use cases for Bitcoin. And that was coincidentally when Franklin launched their program. So Jenny and I had been influencing each other for quite a number of years, and I was watching what the Franklin team had been doing and really had decided by 2022 that I had to be a part of it. So I came over and joined, and we have been doing some really such exciting, cutting edge, market leading things. It's been so satisfying to be part of this and to really be leading a group in a TradFi firm, as you said, Michael, about, you know, what does transformation look like and why can't a traditional firm do it as well as a new industry player. In fact, our head of digital assets, Roger Basedon, has a big thing in his office that he always uses as his backdrop when we do discussions that says, why not us? Mm. And that was really our attitude at Franklin. Why not us?
Why not? So Sandy, why don't you break down a little bit further if you can, you know, this aha moment. You've discovered that, you know, an asset can have a smart contract embedded in it. Well, so what? What did that open up in terms of opportunities for you in terms of reinventing, you know, finance and investing?
Yeah, so it's a great question, Michael. So there's a few aspects to it, right? I had been doing a lot of work in operations, right, for big financial institutions and been doing a lot of work in prime finance and financing. And so much of what happens in today's financing, collateral management, asset servicing is all about reconciling contract terms that are held in documents that are often just PDF'd at best, right? Sometimes they're still in physical manual form with market actions. And are those actions allowed? Are they being properly administered? Are they meeting the terms of the contract? And there's so many teams whose jobs today are really taking the terms in paper locked documents and checking them against daily market activities and trying to identify whether things are going forward on an allowed basis, or are they violating certain covenants, or are they within or outside of certain parameters. And that's all being done almost completely manually, right? So there's huge inefficiencies in the system there and big frictions that can lead to large amounts of fails of trades, large amounts of recalls, resets, all sorts of issues operationally that you have to deal with when you're trying to do some of the more advanced financing and more advanced collateral management activities. And then we also were dealing with a lot of derivative products where those contracts beyond the standard ISDA terms were very much determined by the bilateral negotiation between the counterparties. And those contracts too required so much manual intervention and reconciliation. And so this idea that the contract could be in the asset and could be monitored 24/7, 365, and if certain trigger activities are met, an action would automatically occur, right? That just seemed to me that that would eliminate huge amounts of inefficiencies and huge amounts of frictions that were already in the system.
What really drew you to this in the first place was the core element of the technology, right? And so this idea that you could realize not just efficiencies, but actually gain accuracy because you're mitigating or in some cases completely eliminating the possibility of human error, right? Because you're relying on the code to self-execute, which is what a smart contract, of course, is. And I find that really interesting because I find that when I talk to people whose backgrounds are in more traditional finance or even traditional law, you know, like mine to some extent, that is consistent. There's a consistency to that because regardless of where the number was up or down or this or that or price or volume or whatever, right? TVL, any of those things, that remains true. And that remains immutable, if you will, right, as a fact. And so I'm curious, you know, at how, so given that reality, but then pairing that with the also real reality, the very, you know, very in our faces reality, that this asset was tremendously volatile for a long period of time and still is not what I would say is non-volatile, but certainly has settled a bit, right? Did that erode your sort of confidence or excitement about the technology? Did you feel like, you know, or were you like, oh, those are completely separate things? They're not as related as people think they are. What was your take on the marriage of those two realities?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, there's the theoretical value of, oh, the contract were in the asset, that would be great. And we can actually make that work for us. And then the practical reality of, well, what's it actually like working in these blockchain spaces? And this is where I think Franklin Templeton's experience really is quite unique, because we have been running our fund, our tokenized government money market fund, on the public blockchain rails and now on multiple public blockchain rails for several years now. And the learnings you get as you do that become very multi-layered, right? They kind of come one after another after another.
Right.
And one of the first things we learned was that you need to hold these coins to pay for your transactions. So suddenly we have these coins in our treasury that we need to be able to hedge. And, you know, the best way to hedge them is to become a node on the network where you are actually participating in the network and getting the rewards to offset the disinflationary impacts of the currency issuance. So we started to run our own node operations and become part of the network. And then once you're part of the networks, you suddenly realize that there is a lot of activity that happens that you need to see, right? That you need to actually watch the flow and understand how the transactions are moving and the wallets they're moving from. And that to us made us understand that if we're going to be investing in this space, we need to be a fiduciary and we need to really, you know, we came to understand that verifying transactions as part of the network is really likely to become in the future a new due diligence, a new sort of fiduciary responsibility. And what we also realized is that by aggregating transactions across so many different industries, which is nothing that the financial industry had ever done before, right? We're not used to this idea that our transactions are aggregated with gaming transactions, right, and social media transactions and, right? But by aggregating them in that way, the cost savings and the network speed and the network security that comes along with that was so compelling. And this is still, I think, a learning that those who are not actually engaged in the network economy don't understand yet, right? With people try and transfer their traditional financial mindset to these new technologies, they inevitably go to this idea of private blockchains or permission chains, because they're trying to recreate the security that they feel confident in the old Web 2 system, but not realizing that in the Web 3 system, it's the private chains, it's these chains that have very few nodes and very few people constantly testing the security that are the less secure. So, you know, you get these layers of learning when you get into actually operating in the blockchain space.
It's interesting. The other big institution that people often point to as having been early in this space is Fidelity. There's a long-standing kind of, I don't know, rivalry, frenemies, maybe might way to describe the two of you. And Abby Johnson, the other Johnson, is a, you know, another female CEO who's been leading this. And I've always been impressed by both of you for actually doing that, for running nodes, for participating. And I think that's just been really, really important. You said something about the way, and I see it all the time, right? This sort of cookie cutter. People trying to jam the square peg of this new asset class and structure into the round hole of the existing traditional financial system. And it just doesn't fit. Permission blockchains, whatever it is, these things get created. Things that probably shouldn't be called securities get called securities, but we won't go into that, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering, do you therefore feel it's simply a lack of understanding? Like, and that this is just the taxonomy that people have in their heads and we can't get out of it. I suppose, or you know, resistance, because this is a challenge to the existing stance, the existing position. There's a lot of money and value tied up in the old ways. And if so, or either way you come down on that question, what do we need to do to move, you know, more of the financial system into this environment?
I'll say this. I think that both those things are going on, Michael. I also think that financial services and investing in particular has been an industry where we are very slow to embrace new technologies and new changes in the way that things work. My team and I have uncovered a really fun article from the 1980 or 81, I forget exactly which, but the IPO of Apple. And it was an article where Massachusetts brokers were being warned against allowing their clients to invest in Apple because Apple was such a disruptive company. They thought that that would be a very unsafe investment. So I laughed so hard because this is something, again, that we saw when the internet came out. This is when I was doing a lot of technology consulting, and the number of institutions that said, well, no, we could never move any of our business into the internet model because that would be far too risky. Of course, they all ended up launching websites and having internet models. When cloud technologies came out, the number of institutions that said, oh, we could never put any of our data into the cloud. We could never use service-based models. Today, they're all putting their data in the cloud. They're all using service-based models. So I think there's also just a recurring resistance to adapting to new technologies, which in this case is being exacerbated because the technologies themselves really are very disruptive to the underlying business models of many of the participants in the space. But I think that this is a very well-proven gut reaction of anything new is bad and we must do it the old way until people kind of run out of that excuse.
I'm excited to share with you that our biggest fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, a book I co-authored with Project Liberty founder Frank McCourt, will be released on March 12 and is now available for pre-order. Our biggest fight is a manifesto on the need to fix a severely broken internet with a set of workable solutions for all of us to follow. It's a hopeful book, exploring the big opportunities for innovation and prosperity that technology can bring if it's designed with humans in mind. But it's also an urgent call to action. We must get this right for society now, before it's too late. Find the link to the book in the show notes. Global crypto regulation, the disruptive power of AI, the rise of tokenization. Consensus is the one event where experts in digital assets, blockchain, and related topics convene to talk about the ideas shaping our digital future. Join developers, investors, founders, brands, policymakers, and plenty more in Austin, Texas from May 29 to 31. The 10th annual Consensus is curated by CoinDesk to feature the industry's most sought-after speakers, unparalleled networking opportunities, and unforgettable experiences. Take 15% off registration with the code MRP15. Register now at consensus.coindesk.com. So one of the things that I've found interesting talking to Jenny and to you over the last couple of years is I suppose, another way of looking at the potential impact and changes that this model will apply to investing. You described a moment ago, I think, more of a back office aspect of this, the efficiencies that come with removing all of those steps in the reconciliation and settlement of trades and so forth. But I've also been interested in Franklin Templeton's mindset around creating products that have new opportunities for a sort of almost like a new class of investor. And I think correct me if I'm misstating here, but this idea almost of the younger generation, a younger pool of investors that you need to draw into this mutual fund environment, and perhaps bundling new forms of assets for them, cultural assets, music, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Franklin Templeton has sort of been, you know, talking to a range of musicians about these things. So maybe talk through that a little bit. Like, what's going on there, and what do you see as the opportunities in the future that come with this approach?
Yeah. So I think that one of the real issues that we have been committed to as an organization at Franklin Templeton for years now is this idea that we need to democratize access to alternatives to give individual investors more opportunities in their portfolios, right? We have seen institutional investors migrate 20, 25% of their portfolio, some of the big endowments up to 50% or more of their portfolio into illiquid alternative assets. But the majority of individual investors simply can't qualify to participate in those types of opportunities. And there's been some experimentation to see, can we make more liquid versions of these traditional alternatives? And we think those are great efforts and that they should continue. But we also think that maybe for individuals, a different type of alternative might be a better investment, right? That an alternative that can really be understood by the individual, that they can relate to in their own life. We think that these might be more comfortable investments, particularly for younger generations. And to go back to the beauty of having a contract in an asset, many of these types of assets, which would have been far too difficult to administer, to open up to huge pools of investors, can now be looked at in a new manner because of the ability to have smart contracts. And I think the easiest example here to understand is royalties, right? Music royalties, digital royalties, right? Today, administering royalties is an incredibly complex business, very manual still, very difficult, big delays between the time the payouts occur and the time that they're paid. But with smart contracts, they can start to automate a lot of that. And things today that are difficult to do across dozens of participants can become, over time, very easy to do across hundreds of thousands of participants. And so we believe that these new technologies, this new tokenization structure, the smart contracts, the ability to use the blockchain, we think that this is going to open up a lot of these new types of alternatives in ways that, you know, we just simply couldn't see before, right? Both from the ability to administer the contracts, because we need to know how to actually, who owns these assets, how are they utilized, how are they stored, who has the right to make decisions about them, right? Those are all contractual terms that have to sit within these assets. But at the same time, they have to be fractionalizable to a level where an individual investor who has a small amount of money to invest could still diversify into these assets. So, you know, we really feel that the tokenization structure meets both the fractionalization needs and the contract administration needs that need to be combined to create these new assets. And we're exploring, you know, the regulatory structures that might actually even facilitate that, that are already on the books, things like Reg A structures, Reg D structures, right? There are structures on the book where you can create these kind of crowdfunded securities. And so we're really trying to find the right pathway to start to expand the set of alternative investments for individuals. And it's something we're pretty committed to as an organization. And, you know, it's not going to be a fast to market because, you know, you need to really work through a lot of kinks around valuation and free pricing and secondary market liquidity. But we don't think that those are unreconcilable hurdles. And we do think that these will become a very important new product category to really expand our options beyond kind of the equities and bonds and the traditional securities that people have been kind of brought up on from the older generations.
Sandy, I love so much about what you're saying. So, you know, what I'm hearing is you're really talking about, okay, the technology, so the efficiency, the finality, the reliability via smart contracts of that, right? So taking out some of the uncertainty around not only will I actually get my royalty payment, but when will I get it? Can I prove that I got, you know, all of that, right? Which is very complicated. That's a great example. But then also, I love this idea that who has access to investments? What does an investment mean? You know, and so one thing I've had a bone to pick with for a long time is the concept of accredited investors, right? And the sort of, in my view, very patronizing approach that takes, right? And I understand the reasons behind that. I understand certainly, you know, the safety and the idea that you're equating wealth with sophistication, which isn't necessarily true, you know, all these kinds of things, right? And I just think that we know that the premise there is fundamentally flawed at this point in time. The ability to access information from different sources, to self-educate, all of that is just so different than it was when those rules were first put into place and when they were kind of considered and landed, right? So I've had a bone to pick with that for some time. Little known fact, the company that I worked for, which is a big social enterprise, filed one of the very first Reg A pluses. And I thought that was it was a nice way of trying to kind of say, okay, like, let's take a crowdfunding kind of model and let's see if we can bring more of that community of support into a project and think about expanding the opportunity of investment and of return to a broader set of individuals. And what you're saying is going even further than that. So I'm curious to hear you say you are working with and you're kind of looking at Reg A and Reg D. Maybe we can go a little bit into what are we talking about when we talk about Reg A and Reg D, and, you know, just a little bit about maybe the background of why those matter to the space that we're in, and particularly the work that you're doing. So let's do a little bit of that. But then also, you know, going further, it would seem to me, you know, it's time, I think it's beyond time for the next level, the next generation of models around this that provide permissions and safety and soundness and structure and open up opportunities to a much broader class of investors. And I would say really kind of a limitless class. Maybe age is the only real limit, right? I don't think we want like a 12-year-old necessarily making investments on behalf. Maybe there's a limit there. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. But that maybe that being one of the real only limits in terms of what people get to do and decide to do with their money. So I'm curious to get your reactions to some of that. Maybe you start with a little bit of a backgrounder for our listeners who may not be as familiar with some of these regulations and why they matter.
Sure, Sheila. I love the points you brought up. Those are excellent. So Reg A, right, Reg A Plus, which has come since then, were kind of an outgrowth of the Jobs Act that came out in 2012. And we were starting to see a lot of new crowdfunded sourced models, right? You know, we went into the platform economy. The platform economy allowed multi-sided commerce. Once we got to multi-sided commerce, as opposed to point-to-point commerce, you started to have a lot of new types of models that began to emerge and models that could invite many participants into the same transaction. And so, you know, the government to encourage this type of growth really allowed for this new type of crowdfunded exchange to be a legally recognized entity. And they gave them a structure for them to issue fractional securities under these new rules of Reg A and Reg D. And the differences really come down to how much funds you want to raise and how big a pool of investors you're looking to have. But it gave a regulatory framework for this idea of fractional investments, many people investing into one investment. And that was a really critical, I think, evolution in the industry. But interestingly, a lot of the traditional asset managers did not pick up on that or go anywhere with it. Right. And I think in part because it was very hard to think about how do you scale businesses like that. And now this tokenization, we feel like that ability to scale those businesses becomes very possible. And I think that there is a real hunger from people to feel like they relate to what's in their portfolio. You talked about this idea of an accredited investor disappearing and people being able to really have more options and more freedom. How about more experiences, right? I mean, a lot of times these investments that we hold too often just sit off to the side of our life and don't give us anything until we're ready to retire, which is a long time to wait in a period where people are working less and less time in jobs and where there are more and more gig workers. It's like, in a sense, that old model of retirement just doesn't work as well for many people in the population. So this idea that my investment portfolio could do more for me is very appealing, right? So in addition to all the legal contractual terms and utilization terms that you can put into a contract, you can also put enjoyment terms, right? You can put in perks and rewards and benefits. So we think that it's not only is the concept of accredited investor likely to shift, but the idea of what should my investment deliver is likely to expand. And, you know, just like I carry my Ticketmaster tickets around in my digital wallet, and when I'm ready to go to the concert, I just call it up in my wallet and show them, you know, the QR code on my digital ticket. The investment assets I own could be used just as effectively to unlock opportunities for me. And so I think that you're going to see an expansion both in what gets attached to investments. In many ways, we might see almost a merging of loyalty programs and investing programs. And I think that you're going to see a huge expansion in who can participate. And even for 12-year-olds, right? I mean, hey, a 12-year-old might be great at picking a sneaker portfolio, right? So you might even see the kinds of assets that people get trained on change as they grow. And you might want young people to start getting investment experiences with kind of starter funds that are in things that young kids really enjoy and helps to teach them financial discipline. So I think that, you know, there's really so many positives to be gained by realigning the system and kind of aligning the types of assets that are available to people to what they are able to invest in. Right now, we've said because alternatives are so illiquid, because they are very professionally driven, it's not appropriate for a lot of individuals to be able to get into those assets. But in a sense, it's the nature of the assets, not the nature of the individual that's making that tough. And if we change the assets and make the assets more approachable and liquid, I think that we can change that perception of what is suitable for people to be able to invest in.
I love this idea of really a very dynamic portfolio that you're engaging with, right? And it is so different, to your point, from certainly what I was taught of a woman of a certain age, you know, but even I would say people 10 years younger than me or 15 years younger than me, were taught as well, you know, this idea that, well, it's just the way things are done when you kind of wind up in your first job and you go into your, you know, your 401k and they're like, here are your choices. And you pick your year of retirement. And they're like, this is the diversification we're going to put in there. And then you just kind of, and the whole point is like, set it and forget it. Right.
Right.
And that is, you're right. That's not how people engage with their lives anymore. People are very active. And you see that, I mean, fandom is different, right? We went from kind of like, either you were like hardcore, like groupie model, you know, or you were like enjoying music. But now it's like there's a dialogue happening, right? We even have terms for this in terms of social psychology about your feeling that you are parasocial relationships, right? You're connected to somebody you've never met, but you have this kind of relationship with them. And that has meaningful psychological ramifications that are becoming more and more profound and pronounced, right? Which is fascinating and another topic for another time. But the idea is this is happening in our culture all over the place. So why not think about our investments in a similar way? And I think that is not only digital native, it's just a reflection of reality and of the sort of level of engagement people just expect and by default have with the things that they do.
And just to add to your point, right, when we see these kind of social communities that are developing, having fun is a big part of them, right?
Absolutely.
It's not as serious, right? We tend to be very serious in TradFi, but a lot of times, you know, these are more fun and you'll see a cat fly through, you know, as you're getting your investment advice or you'll, right? So I think that, you know, there's also this idea of it can be fun, right? It can be social. It can be fun. These are new, I think, aspects of investing that those of us coming from the more traditional side of the industry have to kind of get more comfortable embracing, because this is the new audience and you know, it is where it's coming from. I mean, I make sure to have very young people on my team because I know I natively would not understand these models, right? Mm-hmm. I have to really listen to the generations that they're geared at and understand what it is that is appealing to them about it, because they are going to be the ones investing their money. So we need to develop a system that they are going to feel attracted to. And I think it is different.
I think it's also really important, the more I'm listening to this and thinking about it, to figure this all out in the context of a new internet, right? And this is where I get to do my shilling of the old book thing. But the book is, you know, really about the problem of centralized platforms and the fact that we do not have control over our data, over our content, that it's all aggregated by these big systems. And a lot of us now, and certainly those who've come through the Web3 world, are saying, look, this is just wrong on all sorts of moral levels. We've seen the harm that it's done to society. We've seen the harm it's done to individuals. And we've seen an absolute distortion in terms of the power and value that is accruing to the platforms and away from the people who are creating the value, right? But what I think is really interesting about what you're saying is that, you know, there's a parallel here if we move to what I would call the kind of, for want of a better word, the ownership economy, that as somebody who now has royalties coming from the musician that I love, and that's my participation in the system of capitalism that drives the broader economy, I'm a participant in a way that I never was before. And I think, you know, listening to both you and Sheila talk, you know, I'm reminded that, you know, most of my career was covering Wall Street. And yeah, we did. We thought of the financial institution and the assets that were, you know, bought and sold on our behalf as very detached from our lives. And yet, the conversation always was in 20th century America that as investors in mutual funds and pensions and so forth, we were contributing to this broader economy. It's just that we didn't participate in the decision making and in the connection with it. And I think that part of the problem with that is we created a system that ended up empowering the intermediaries in all of that. So there's something about this that says, not only is this a more interesting and engaging thing for people to be part of that life, it's empowering in a way that, you know, is actually now critical if we're going to solve a lot of the huge problems facing the world. So I suppose it'd be interesting to hear whether, you know, in your conversations with sort of younger investors and the like, whether they get that. Like, is there an appreciation here? And is it a little bit of a revolution underway, or is it sort of more, that's just Franklin Templeton, it's an old fuddy-duddy firm, I don't want to be there. Are you getting engagement with people, and on what terms?
It's so funny, because the first time I talked about these cultural assets at a conference, the people ran right out of the audience to the Franklin Templeton booth and were like, I want to buy the cultural assets. Where do I go to buy
them? Where do I find them?
First, we have to kind of create them. So we don't have them for sale quite yet. But you bring up such an important point, Michael, because, you know, we talked in the beginning a little bit about how we went into the platform economy and we started to see these multi-sided transactions. But the platform economy was completely intermediated. And as you say, those intermediaries accumulated so much power by being the facilitator of these multilateral, transactions. What we're pivoting to, what we're calling it at Franklin Templeton, is the protocol economy. And by the protocol economy, what we mean is that protocols are free, right? When I type in HTTP into my browser to call up a website, I'm not paying anyone for that HTTP, right? And a lot of these blockchain-based systems now are being built on open source protocols that anyone can call on, anyone can use. They're creating these digital natives that are digital primitives that can be combined into new types of functionality. And just like I can type in HTTP and call up a website, many of these new business models use these protocols to transact a trade, finance a trade, right? These are all becoming things that you can do without a company needing to give you permission to do it. And I think that, you know, what it is doing is it's changing this idea of my role in the system. Because in the platform economy, the closest I could get was to buy the company that built the platform, that drew the network, that created the network effects, right? But now in this new protocol economy, I can buy the token that is the network, right? That drives the network. So in a sense, I own the network. Mm-hmm. And I can eliminate all those other layers between me and the network effects. My participation drives network effects. My ownership of the tokens that represent the network go up in value because the network effects are growing. And it becomes a much more, I think, direct form of participation, and one that is likely to make people feel very engaged and involved because they drive it. As much as, you know, they participate, they also drive it. And my assets that I contribute, my resources that I contribute, even if it's just engagement, are true resources that build the network, and I get rewarded for that. And so I think that you really are changing this concept of the right of ownership. It is my right to own the things that I help to build and create. And I think that will take hold. And it is pretty revolutionary.
Do you have a position on how it evolves in terms of which protocols or what structures around those protocols are going to end up winning? Because I think, you know, one of the interpretations that's a bit more cynical is that we're still ending up in these sort of different forms of not exactly walled gardens, because it is built on open source and it has all the things, but the interoperability across platforms, and that's improving with bridges and a whole host of other aspects of innovation around this. But you're still talking about, you know, is ETH going to win? Is Solana going to win? And I just wonder if that matters. Is it important that we end up with something that's much more of an open, interoperable base layer for the internet, or do you just think this sort of tribalism and sort of like, you know, it's an integral part of competition and capitalism, and we won't be able to get out of it?
I think that, you know, I'm always an optimist, Michael. So my feeling is that we will know that we are really nearing the end of the infrastructure stage of this new economy's development when we do see this interoperability really begin to be the dominant model, right? I think that, you know, because people are going to be owners of networks, they're going to, by nature, want to support certain networks over others. Hmm. But those networks still, I think, are going to have to be able to interoperate with each other, even with some of the private networks that people are still building. And we'll probably have private networks, at least for the rest of your and my life, to some extent. Right. So I don't think we're going to move immediately into this whole new structure where there's no more private, where there's no more competition. But I think that when the infrastructure layer starts to go under the covers, right, and we're not talking about the infrastructure, we're talking about the applications, that's when I think the economy, this protocol economy, will really take off and fly, right? We don't talk about the underlying technologies that enabled social media and two-way web communication. We talk about social media. We talk about Facebook and Uber and all the different models that came about because of the technologies, but we don't talk about the technologies as much anymore. And we're still in the phase now where we're talking about the technologies themselves. And to me, that's a sign that we're still working through the right infrastructure model. And to be fair, I mean, Ethereum's not even 10 years old yet. So how can we expect it to have really kind of hit a final phase? And all these other blockchains are even younger. So I think that you've still got much more development to go. But I think that eventually that entire set of infrastructures, the complexities of operating with a wallet, all of that will become under the covers. And people aren't going to really need to understand that part of it. They're just going to know that they go onto this app that they like and they do this function and they get more for it and more from the assets that they earn from doing those functions.
All right, listen, we're going to wrap now because we do have some of us want to go off and watch this eclipse that's coming very soon. It's a Monday year. Sandy, I mean, just, I don't know, maybe just to close here. I know, of course, there are some issues. Franklin Templeton is one of the contributors, one of the issuers of a Bitcoin ETF. I mean, maybe just a quick take on that because I think it's worth people knowing how that's going and maybe just quickly what other things you're just coming down the pike.
It's been such an exciting year because of these Bitcoin ETF launches. They really, I think, are such an important transition vehicle that is really opening up the understanding of this new space and opening up the ability of a broader set of investors to participate. In a sense, it's putting that access and infrastructure issue under the covers, like we were just talking about. Right. So I can participate in the space, I can get exposure to it, but I don't have to use all of these new unfamiliar things. And the growth of the ETFs has been pretty spectacular, especially considering that the main audiences, which are the big institutions and the big wealth platforms, are still yet to come. Right. Yeah. A lot of this early volume has really been driven by those investors who are self-directed and digitally native and who understand the ecosystem. And we're likely to see the demand profile of new investors coming in continue to expand for probably the next 12 to 18 months. You should see more and more types of investors coming into this marketplace, creating that demand and bringing in the capital that is really going to drive the liquidity and drive the further development of the overall ecosystem. So I think it's been a hugely important product. I think it's been hugely successful even in its earliest iterations, and I think that success will just build and grow pretty much uninterruptedly for at least the next 12 to 18 months, because you're going to have more platforms adding ETFs, you're going to have more institutions getting their investment management committees comfortable with adding ETFs into their portfolio for this space, and then that opens up the whole dialogue about, well, why is this a good investment space? And then I think you really start to see the understanding of the value come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great to wrap and have a positive take on things. Episodes aren't always so positive. This is a nice, positive, optimistic look at where things are going. And indeed, it has been an exciting year. Congratulations to Franklin Templeton on all you're doing in this space, and to you, Sandy, for driving this. Sandy Carr, thank you very much for participating. Thank you, of course, to Sheila, my co-host. Thank you to Michelle Musso, our wonderful producer, editor, and the rest of the CoinDesk team who put this out. That's all we have time for now. Thank you for joining us, and do come back again next week for another episode. Bye for now.